Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the broadcast. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, Pope Francis tells us to open the doors of our hearts and rise up to God's compassion this Jubilee Year of Mercy. Did she die or simply go to sleep? Does it matter? Father Peter Stravinskas takes us to the Holy Land to reflect on Our Lady's Assumption into Heaven. And another great lady of the Church, Edith Stein, or St. Teresa Benedicta of the Cross. Discalced Carmelite Father Ulrich Dobhan knows all about her and gives us some insight into this remarkable saintly woman. Francis says God is telling everyone to rise up. At the general audience, the Pope said the holy door of the Jubilee is the door where the pain of humanity and the compassion of God meet up. Charles Collins tells us more.
The Holy Father was recounting the story of the widow whom Jesus met at the city gate of Nain, which the Pope compared to the Holy Door. She was leaving the city in the funeral procession of her son, whom Jesus raised from the dead with the words, "Rise up." Pope Francis said great compassion guided the actions of Jesus, who decided to face death, as it were, face to face.
Durante questo giubileo sarebbe una buona cosa che nel varcare la porta santa, la porta della misericordia.
The Holy Father said that during this Jubilee year, it would be a good thing as they enter the holy door, the gate of mercy, that pilgrims remember this episode of the Gospel, which took place at the gate into Nain. The Holy Father said this is the door where the suffering of humanity encounters the compassion of God.
Misericordia di Dio che, come al ragazzo morto, ripete a tutti, dico a te, alzati.
Crossing the threshold, we perform our pilgrimage in the mercy of God, who, just as he said to the dead boy, tells everyone, I say to you, rise up, Pope Francis continued. To each of us, he says, rise up. God wants us to stand. He created us to be on our feet. The Pope said that mercy, both in Jesus and in us, is a journey that starts from the heart and goes to the hands.
Mi diceva un vescovo l'altro giorno che nella sua cattedrale.
He told the story of a bishop who established two holy doors, one an entrance, the other an exit. Why, Pope Francis asked? To enter and cross the first door is to ask pardon and to receive the mercy of Jesus. And when you exit the other door, it is the outpouring of mercy, to bring mercy to others with the works of mercy. He said this is what it means to have mercy go from your heart to your hands. I'm Charles Collins.
Each year, the Catholic Church remembers the Assumption of Our Lady into Heaven on August 15th. Different traditions hold that the Virgin Mary left this earthly life between 3 and 15 years after Christ's death and resurrection. She was assumed into heaven, accounts say, as she reposed in eternal sleep, either in Jerusalem or in Ephesus, in modern-day Turkey. While early accounts from the Holy Land reported that a Christian cult venerating Christ's mother had grown up around a place on Jerusalem's Mount Zion, just south of the old city walls. The spot, known from early times as Hagia Maria, continues to this day to be the site of prayers to Our Lady. Today, German-speaking Benedictine monks care for the Catholic Church of the Door Mission built there over the ruins of a series of early Christian shrines. Today, the monks serve the church, its guests and pilgrims, and work for peace and reconciliation in the Holy Land. Well, I sat down with the noted scholar and author Father Peter Stravinskas, who has led us on reflections on the holy sites in the land of Christ's birth, to ask him his thoughts on this Jerusalem shrine, celebrating the Virgin's death and assumption into heaven.
Yes and no. The church is in the care of German Benedictine monks. It's a beautiful, beautiful church. For people who watch EWTN and have seen Father Mitch Pacwa's rosary from the Holy Land, he does the mystery of the Assumption from the Church of the Dormition. The Dormition is the Eastern word for what we celebrate on August 15th. In the West, we refer to it as the Assumption. They refer to it as the Dormition, which means Mary's going to sleep. And when you said it's the church that commemorates Mary's death and assumption, I said yes and no, because there's a divided opinion among theologians and a division of the theology which the church accepts. Some people say that Mary never died. And
that
so
she merely went to sleep.
Went to sleep. Mm-hmm. Hence the word dormition. And it's fascinating if you read Pius XII's promulgation of the dogma of the Assumption, he allows for both theological opinions to coexist in the church. He says, when the course of her earthly life was finished, the Blessed Virgin Mary was assumed body and soul. Well, people who believe, as a matter of fact, that she died, physically died, say, yeah, when the course of her earthly life was finished, she died. But people who hold the alternative that she merely went to sleep and then was taken up into the glory of heaven can also be satisfied by Pius XII's formulation.
And there are people who also describe death as eternal sleep.
Sure, sure. And just in the, an important theological point that we see underscored in Pius XII's carefulness, the Church never pronounces on matters that are inessential and allows for a variety of theological explanations as long as that doesn't threaten a truth. And so no truth is sacrificed by holding either theological position. Now, this site, this Church of the Dormition, is one of three or four places that claim that that's where Our Lady died. Some people say she died in Ephesus, some in Patmos. But at any rate, wherever it happened, wherever her passage into eternity occurred, this is one of the places that claims that. And I think a point to underscore here about this particular church is when Pius XII declared the dogma of the Assumption, promulgated the dogma of the Assumption, some people got it all backwards. They said, there's the Catholic Church making up new dogmas 19 centuries after something happened, now they're making up a new thing that Catholics have to believe. Well, no. When a dogma is promulgated, it simply means that something that was always believed has now reached a sufficient level of theological reflection and maturity that the Church can say, this is now proposed for formal belief. Now, I mention this also because some evangelicals will say, well, there's no evidence of Scripture that Mary was assumed into heaven. Well, there is and there isn't. If you look at the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation, there are very, very strong clues that that's exactly what we're talking about, is her assumption. But more to the point, Pius didn't define in 1950 something brand new. This Church of the Dormition goes back to the 4th century. Its existence, its physical existence, points to the Church's perpetual belief in Mary's bodily assumption. And so this is what is commemorated by that physical site. Now, what does the dogma of the Assumption teach us? It teaches us, first of all, the goodness and the importance of the human body. Right now, there are two people in heaven, body and soul, our Lord, the God-man, and Our Lady, his mother and the mother of the Church. In their persons, we have the new Adam and the new Eve, body and soul, which tell us this is the fulfillment of the entire human race. All of humanity all of saved humanity is, in some sense, already in heaven by virtue of the presence of Jesus and Mary. Secondly, Mary, as the first member of the church, as the mother of the church, is there precisely as the church in glory. She embodies the church in herself. And she, as a good mother, stands at the finish line, beckoning her children to come. And she's there to welcome us to the glory of her son's kingdom. She's also there, in a very important way, as a symbol of redeemed womanhood. She's the new Eve. Everything that was botched up in the first Eve was repaired in the second Eve. And Mary is a model of true feminism, Christian feminism, what a woman is called to be by virtue of her dignity as a daughter of God. And so all of this coalesces in this mystery of the Assumption. At the Second Vatican Council, there was a big discussion as to whether or not there ought to be a special document on the Blessed Virgin. And those that one would consider to be more traditional or conservative argued that there ought to be, and there needed to be, because we need to highlight the place of the Blessed Mother in the life of the Church. Other people said, no, for this reason or that reason, we're not going to move in that direction, but let's include her in the document on the Church. And so the eighth chapter, the last chapter of Lumen Gentium, as a matter of fact, is a sustained theological and spiritual reflection on the place of Mary in the economy of salvation. And what does that do? It inserts her into the very heart of the Church. And as a result of that document, Paul VI declared Mary to be Mother of the Church. And in her, the poet Wordsworth says, is Mary is our tainted nature's solitary boast. Everything that could ever be good in a human person is in her. Cardinal Newman refers to her as the daughter of Eve unfallen. We tend to think of original sin as something, a black mark or this or that. No, sin is an absence. And what's interesting to reflect on, Adam and Eve were created without sin. And so when Newman says that Mary is the daughter of Eve unfallen, by her immaculate conception, God's intervention at the very moment of her creation, her conception, he has preserved her, and he has made her very much what Eve herself was. Sometimes people say, well, if Mary was conceived without sin, no wonder she didn't sin, and she couldn't sin. No, she could sin. She could have sinned. Eve was conceived, was created without sin, but she sinned. Adam was created without sin, and he sinned. No, it's a question that her entire orientation from the moment of her conception was a response to the grace that was given to her. And therefore, she stands again at the finish line as a model, but also as an intercessor, as a mother, bidding us to follow her example and giving us confidence that her intercession, as a matter of fact, will bring us safely home.
Father Peter Stravinskas is a noted Catholic scholar and author and editor of The Catholic Response. From one holy woman to another, whom we also celebrate this August, Edith Stein, or as she is also known, St. Teresa Benedicta of the Cross. This discalced Carmelite nun's feast day falls on the 9th of August each year. To learn more about her, I dipped into our archives and pulled out Veronica Scarisbrick's interview with discalced Carmelite Father Ulrich Dopen, who shares some insight into this extraordinary and brave woman from wartime Germany.
Ave, her personal history, her life, her personality.
What's so special about her personality?
Her personality is a very intelligent woman coming from a Jewish family, outstanding philosopher in Germany. She was an assistant of Edmund Husserl for in these time. In these times, maybe he was the most famous philosopher in Germany. She got the doctorate with him, summa cum laude. And her conversion to Catholicism was not so normal, because in this time many, many Jewish converted to Christianism, but to the Protestant confession. And she, led or convinced by Teresa of Avila,
who lived before
in the 16th century, in the 16th century in Spain, convinced by her, finally she decided to become a Catholic Christian in the Catholic Church.
The sequence of her conversion was strange. Jewish born, then she was atheist at one point.
She never uses the word atheist. She used the word unbeliever. And in the age of 14, it was in Hamburg, when she was in the house of her sister, she decided to give up all the prayers. It doesn't mean that she became an atheist, especially her niece living in California, the daughter of her youngest sister. She always insists, saying it is not a real atheism when a girl with 15 or 14 years old decides to give up the prayers. Another question is, in what an extent she had known the real Jewish religion? Because after, when she was a Catholic, she discovered the religious richness of Jewish religion. And I'm sure that after, as a Catholic, she was a better Jewish believer than before. The Catholic faith, the Christian faith, helped her to discover the richness of the Jewish religion.
She wasn't an atheist, as you said, but she was certainly a woman of doubt, a seeker.
Yes, a seeker. It's a very good, it's a very good word, a seeker.
Do you think that this doubt that she went through, this pain and this... when one doubts, so there's always a bit of pain, no?
Yes, sort of moral pain.
It confirmed her so much as a staunch believer.
She was always seeking, and she was always thinking, because she didn't like to accept some things or some articles of faith when she hadn't studied them before as well as possible. It is interesting, before she converted to Catholic religion, she studied two very famous Catholic theologians, Möller, Johann Adam Möller, and Matthias Scheben. In her times, these two professors were very famous with her dogmatic books. It means she wanted to understand the things well as possible with her intellect. And this means that she was doubting, and but also seeking always.
When she made her eternal profession on the 21st of April, 1938, this erudite woman then, what you're saying, she was an erudite woman, she chose the words of another famous Carmelite, St. John of the Cross, to be printed on her devotional picture.
Yes.
But she wrote, "Henceforth my only vocation is love."
Yes.
So what is it? The intellect and love go together?
You must know that this text comes from the spiritual canticle of St. John of the Cross, the most outstanding poet in Spanish language. And she made a very good translation of this canticle later. I think that love and intellect are not in opposition, because a love without intellect is not good, and intellect without love is not even good.
So what you're saying, she's a very mature, complete
person.
Yes,
exactly, exactly. Two qualities complementing each other. One of the most important themes of John Paul II, in his last encyclical, I think it was his last encyclical, when he spoke also about Edith Stein in this context. Wie das Et ratio, exactly.
Faith and reason, which yes. is one of Pope mm-hmm. Benedict XVI's mm-hmm. great
Although
things.
Yes.
Faith
he,
continue,
he continues. Also, Deus Caritas is to have the thing.
God is love. One can't speak of Edith Stein without speaking of Auschwitz. I think that
yes.
she is well known
yes.
for her
yes,
experience
exactly.
at Auschwitz and her witness.
I think it is one of the other points why she is such an important person, such an outstanding person of the last century, because she finished in Auschwitz, and she had accepted this kind of death willingly, even if she tried to escape until the last moment. She was always hoping, but she was at the same time very resigned to accept it as God had decided for her. I think she testimonies that God was present in Auschwitz, giving her strength. But I think it is a very difficult question. We cannot speak so easily about God, but Edith Stein was convinced until the last moment that God is with her.
Pope Benedict, when he went to Auschwitz, he spoke of Edith Stein, and he said of her that he felt a deep urge to pause in a particular way before the inscription in German evoking her.
Ad Auschwitz-Birkenau, e qui sono morti,
and he said he greatly hailed her and the others as witnesses to the truth and goodness, which even among our people were not eclipsed. We are grateful
Ringraziamo queste persone
because they did not submit to the power of evil.
Perché non si sono sottomesse al potere del male.
And now they stand before us like lights shining
e
in a dark
ci
night.
Stanno davanti come luci in una notte buia.
The reading of Edith Stein, a light shining in a dark night?
I think so, especially when we take in consideration her end, because her writings giving really a testimony about faith, and especially her last writing, Signs of the Cross, about St. John of the Cross, is finishing with the light of the resurrection. Edith Stein in her writing, Signs of the Cross, is giving a comment about all the writings of St. John of the Cross, putting her own experience. It is a mixture between a comment and testimony of life. It finishes with the light of the resurrection. Can suppose that in the last days before she was captured, she was writing this, because the writing is nearly finished, but it's only written by hand, it's a manuscript, and she was still working about it. And so we can suppose that in the last weeks before she was captured, she had developed these thoughts about the light of the resurrection, following the prayer of the Angelus. The Angelus is the angel of the Lord, that we can come through his suffering and cross to the glory of resurrection.
Stein had to face the challenges of a radically changing century with its deep wounds and scars, a world of renunciation. No, she had to face that kind of world, whereas our Western world today is a world where everything is allowed. So what has she got to offer? What is the relevance of her witness to the new generations? There doesn't seem to be a lot in common.
I think that she was a person in search, a seeker. And I think under the relativism and under many other things we are living now, many persons are looking for values, are seeking for values, and so don't trust so easily the traditional values, but they are seeking. We should encourage the people to be seekers. Even if you are not always succeeding, maybe we are used to be succeeding, but faith is to be a seeker, in spite of all the insuccesses and all the problems you have, all the sins you are doing. It is important to remain in the way, to continue the way.
We mentioned two Carmelites earlier on in our talk, St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila, from whom she drew inspiration. Mm-hmm. Would you say that she has a particular Carmelite charism?
Yes, in a certain sense. She had entered very well in the traditional Carmelite charism, in the Theresian Carmelite charism.
Which, what is it? What is the Theresian?
The prayer, interior prayer. It's a typical Theresian charism when it was not so common in the order. And St. John of the Cross, yeah, she had understood him also, but maybe St. John of the Cross insists more in love. He doesn't never use the expression a science of cross, but a science of love. We know that the real love accepts also the cross, but Edith Stein insists more in the cross. There are many crosses in her life, many crosses, not only Auschwitz, not only Auschwitz.
St. Teresa, then, of the cross, where does the Benedicta come in, then?
Benedicta, blessed by the cross, yes. Her name became a reality in her life.
Thanks there to Veronica Scarisbrick for that interview with Discalced Carmelite Father Ulrich Dobhan. Been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. I hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast. If you'd like to find out more about our programming, do check out our webpage. The address is www.rv.va, and then click on the English World icon. You can also like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, and download the Vatican Radio app. Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. Laudetur Jesus Christus.